The beginnings of the Second World War in Europe. That's our focus on this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David Mackenzie. On this program, we will assume that you did listen to your history teacher at the right time in school and already know the basic sequence of events during the last week of August and the first week of September 1939. If not, simply record this program and come back to it after you've read a couple of applicable books at the library. For the rest of you, we go to the 27th of August, 1939, with Bob Trout at Columbia Broadcasting System headquarters in New York, calling in H.V. Kaltenborn in London.
The news of Europe as it occurs. Although in many European nations the military preparations of war go grimly on, today as yesterday, it is still London which dominates the news. British Ambassador to Germany, Sir Neville Henderson, several times rumored on the verge of returning to Berlin, is still in the capital of the British Empire. And today, as the unprecedented Sunday cabinet meeting ended, it was announced that the British cabinet will meet again tomorrow at noon in London. And now, let us hear London's latest news direct from that city, brought to us by Columbia's news analyst, H.V. Kaltenborn. And so, we switch you now to London. Hello, London. This is New York calling you. This is Bob Trout calling H.V. Kaltenborn in London. New York calling London. Mr. Kaltenborn, if you can hear us, we are ready for you now.
And here we are. We've been waiting for your call, and by one of those peripatetics that occasionally occur in even the best regulated radio, we've been hearing a raucous German voice for the last minute, while you have been waiting for a less raucous one from London. We understand that you know all about the further meeting of the cabinet that is to take place at noon tomorrow, that you have heard that Mr. Neville Henderson, who has been here attending every cabinet meeting that has taken place for the last 2 days, is to fly back to Berlin tomorrow with Britain's answer to Adolf Hitler's demands. We have not been told whether Sir Neville Henderson will remain for the further cabinet meeting, which is to take place at noon tomorrow, but a reasonable guess would be that since he has attended all the previous meetings, and since this further meeting undoubtedly is to give some further consideration to the reply and its implications, one would guess that it is probable that he will remain until after that meeting. The cabinet here has issued an official communique announcing what I have just told you, and then added a phrase to the effect that the publication of the details of Adolf Hitler's demands is, quote, entirely unauthorized and inaccurate. Now, I understand that you in New York have had certain details with reference to those demands, that you have been given to understand that Adolf Hitler's demands, as presented and discussed by the British cabinet, include 4 separate items. And I should like to consider briefly with you those items. First, the return immediately to Germany of Poland's Polish corridor and of the city of Danzig and the territory which has been included in the Free State of Danzig under the League of Nations Constitution. That is point number one. Well, that, I think, is a reasonable point from Herr Hitler's point of view. After all, he has insisted that he must have Danzig, and his first demand was only for a road through the corridor. But those of us who studied that demand realized that that, as he put it, really meant cutting the corridor off from Polish control and making it almost inevitable that the corridor should sooner or later fall to Germany, at least in good part. So this is what he asked of Poland several months ago, and of course, in addition, an outright demand for the cession of the corridor. Now, That, I should say, it is reasonable to assume Adolf Hitler would ask. Then, after making that demand, he proceeds in the second point that has been suggested as included in what he has asked, that he would be willing to participate in an international conference that would discuss disarmament and colonies. Disarmament in the sense that Germany would be willing to reduce her armaments if other countries would do likewise. To discuss colonies in the sense that Germany would be getting some colonies from somebody who was willing to give them up to her. Then the third point, an international conference which would discuss these points would, in Mr. Hitler's opinion, last a long time. Therefore, his Polish claims, that is the claim for Danzig and for the corridor, those claims would have to be satisfied before this international conference took place. And then finally, the fourth part of his presentation to the British cabinet is supposed to have been an assurance of German-British friendship as being natural and traditional and as responding to the desires of the two peoples. Well, I've talked briefly about the naturalness of demand number one for the corridor and Danzig. Now, secondly, as to the international conference, well, Hitler has never indicated that he has any preference for international conferences or any desire for them, nor has he indicated at any time that he is willing or eager to discuss the matter of reducing armaments. As to colonies, well, that's an additional demand, and he has at various times indicated that he feels that those demands should be presented. Then, in the third place, his insistence that Poland must immediately turn the corridor and Danzig over to him, since the international conference to discuss the other things would take a long time, that too, coming from Herr Hitler, is a perfectly natural demand. The assurance of German-British friendship, well, that's something that he assured in Mein Kampf. Hitler always had the idea that he could cooperate with the British and with the Italians against almost all the rest of the world. That was the basis of his policy. That is why, as his associates put it, he signed the naval agreement with Britain and would have been willing to go along with Britain if, from his point of view, Britain had gone along with him. Now, what about this, as demands like these strike the British cabinet? Well, obviously, if the British cabinet is going to do what it has said right along it will do, it certainly will not say to Herr Hitler, take the corridor, take Danzig, and we'll be delighted to discuss giving colonies to you, and then perhaps we'll be very happy to have you collaborate with us in reducing armaments. And of course we understand that since this is going to take a long time, that you're in too much of a hurry to wait, so it's quite all right with us that you should have the corridor and Danzig right away. Well, you can't see Britain making that decision, nor can I, nor can anyone who has studied the temper of the British people as we see it here expressed in a unanimous British press today, which does say quite definitely, Adolf Hitler, we are not going to yield to you this time as we have yielded before. So, of course, if these demands represent what Hitler has asked, and in a sense one guess is as good as another, this is the sort of thing that on the basis of Hitler's record, I think one has a right to assume that he might ask, and it's quite possible that enough has leaked out from one or more of the foreign representatives who have been called in to discuss with the British cabinet this situation. And we must remember that the Polish ambassador has been called in, the French ambassador has been called in, the Greek minister has been called in, and I ask myself, the Polish ambassador, he wants to do the best that he can for his country in this time of crisis. Could he advantage his country by making it clear to the world as soon as he could
that such exaggerated demands as these have been put forward by Adolf Hitler? And my answer is that perhaps yes. Perhaps he would feel that the sooner that type of demand is known to the world, the sooner it would be possible to create a public opinion in Britain, in France, in Poland, in America, in all the world, against the complete granting of those demands. And so, it's quite possible that we have here more than an inkling of what the real demands are, even though the story that we have is necessarily unofficial. And it's quite natural, too, that the British cabinet should be concerned that news of what Hitler had asked should not leak out in order to create opinion, in order to create excitement, in order to bring about pressure against the cabinet and against everyone concerned at this particular stage. Because I should imagine that what the British government, with true British diplomatic skill, has done today is to work over each one of the demands that Hitler has made, to try and see if there is not some way of turning them, of perhaps partially granting them, or perhaps, and this is more likely still, of postponing them. Because the British technique from the beginning of this crisis has been the technique of postponement. You can see that in the leisurely way in which these demands that Sir Neville Henderson has brought have been handled. After all, if they had felt that it was of great advantage, Sir Neville Henderson could have started back for Berlin on Saturday even. And yet here he is, still with us today, and probably will be with us here in London for the better part of tomorrow. And so you have this technique of postponement. Now, ask yourself, what kind of reply would the British government then make to demands as exaggerated, as impossible of acceptance, as those which we see outlined here as the possible demands which Hitler has made? Well, they would try to work out some plan under which Poland and Germany could be brought together to discuss those things among themselves. I'm inclined to think that Hitler's rejection of any outside mediation leaves only the first of President Roosevelt's proposed methods of negotiation open, namely that of a direct discussion between Poland and Germany. Perhaps a direct discussion in which each side might have the right to call in one friend, Germany perhaps, calling in Italy, Poland, calling in Britain, and then endeavoring to work out some solution of this first of the demands, which, after all, is at the present time the key to the whole situation. There is no chance of the thing being accepted. There is no chance that Britain or France or Poland will say to Adolf Hitler, take the corridor, take Danzig, and then we'll be very happy to sit down with you and discuss what else you may want. No, it's gone beyond that. We're facing a different situation than we did at Munich. And the more I study and sense the temper of the British people, the more I'm convinced that the British government willy-nilly will have to take that temper into account and will have to play fair with Poland in this crisis. Good afternoon.
That was London's latest news, brought to us direct from that city by Columbia's news analyst H.V. Kaltenborn, who will, you know, speak to us on his regular Sunday program tonight at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Now, while reminding you once again that by listening to your Columbia station, you will hear the latest news bulletins interrupt as the regular schedule is interrupted and as these bulletins come in. And now, just before closing this program, let me remind you of a few of the broadcasts which Columbia is planning to bring you on the European situation throughout the day. At 5:30 Eastern Daylight Saving Time, we plan a roundup of important European capitals with news analysts telling you the latest word from those capitals. At 9:30 Eastern Daylight Saving Time, we shall try to bring you the voice of Richard Maurer of the Chicago Daily News' Foreign Service, speaking to us from the capital of Poland, from Warsaw. And then at 10 p.m. New York time, from Berlin, William L. Shira, the chief of Columbia's Continental Staff. At 10:30, as we said, Mr. Kaltenborn's regular broadcast tonight from London. And then at midnight, we shall hear again from Berlin, and from then on, as many of the European capitals as we can bring in to you. This is Bob Trout speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Now for the following day, the 28th of August, 1939. William L. Shirer is in Berlin.
Hello, America. Hello, CBS. This is Berlin. The sands are running fast. Tonight, here in Berlin, we should have a decision whether it's to be peace or war. It's just 8:58 Berlin time, and Sir Neville Henderson, the British ambassador, is due to arrive any minute now from London. A big Mercedes car is waiting for him out at the Tempelhof aerodrome, and we'll rush him to Herr Hitler's chancellery in the Wilhelmstrasse as soon as he arrives. The outcome of this historic meeting is now in the lap of the gods. Although word has sifted through this afternoon that the British government cannot accept the demands which Herr Hitler made public last night, namely a return of Danzig and the corridor to Germany, the Wilhelmstrasse, when I left it a few minutes ago, was maintaining silence, preferring to wait until it knew what Ambassador Henderson brought back. The feeling in German government circles on the eve of this crucial meeting is still firm. And the entire press this evening maintains that Germany cannot and will not compromise, that the Reich will not budge an inch from its demands on Poland for the return of Danzig in the corridor. It is not entirely ruled out, of course, that the British answer, which it's believed contains certain counter-proposals, may necessitate a reply. But the tension has become so terrific that it does not seem possible to anyone here that it can long continue, probably not past tonight, without events taking a turn one way or the other. Or as the Germans say, so oder so. In the meantime, Germany seemed already on a complete war footing today. Housewives stood in lines beginning early this morning to get their ration cards. It was the first time since the war that these cards had made their appearance. And the people, who had hardly believed a couple of days ago that war was possible, certainly looked grimmer as they stood patiently waiting for their cards. With true German efficiency, the rationing system swung into operation very smoothly. At any store today, if you wanted certain foodstuffs or soap or shoes, you had to show your card. Otherwise, you were politely turned down. The newspapers and the radio have assured the population several times today that there is food and clothing and soap and shoes and fuel enough for every German, that the rationing was only resorted to in the interests of fairness to all. But everyone taking the new measures with good, by taking these measures with good grace, the people are told, they are helping to defend the freedom of Germany. Most papers praise the German woman for the calmness with which she has taken not only the rationing of foodstuffs and materials, but also the spirit with which she has seen her menfolk, husbands, sons, or fathers, off to the army in the last few days. The military took an ever-increasing part in the picture in Berlin as today advanced. Cars with high army officers sped up and down the Wilhelmstrasse, or down the Tiergartenstrasse to the War Ministry in the Benderstrasse. Many cars and motorcycles were requisitioned. I saw several civilian motorcyclists who had been called up with their vehicles. They received an army armband, and you could see them speeding through the streets carrying messages. Despite the needs of the armed forces, the gasoline situation improved today. I was able to buy 2 gallons a few minutes ago, which enabled me to get here in time for this broadcast. Men from the air service supervised the tanking up. Squadrons of big bombers have also been roaring low over the city in formation. In other words, though the talking stage has not yet been completely abandoned, the grim preparation for the worst goes on. I understand no trains from Germany crossed any borders today, but those foreigners trying to get out were able to proceed as far as the frontier and then either walk or get some kind of transportation to the other side of the border. Note that Germany has already assured Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Switzerland that it will respect their neutrality in case of war. But tonight we heard that Holland had decided to mobilize. Well, all depends now on the talks, which will be beginning here in a few minutes between Herr Hitler and the British ambassador. I hope to be on the air later tonight to tell you what I can about those talks. This is William L. Shire, and returning you now to New York.
The morning of the 1st of September, 1939, 4 hours after the Nazi invasion of Poland has already begun.
Those assembled arise and stand to greet the arrival of the German Führer. The applause greets the Führer, who has just arrived in the Kohl Opera House to address the Reichstag, which has been called an extraordinary session. We are expecting that Prime Minister Göring, in a very few moments, will open formally the session in the Reichstag.
War und ist eine deutsche Stadt.
Danzig was and is a German city.
Alle diese Gebiete verdanken ihre kulturelle Erschließung ausschließlich dem deutschen Volk.
All these regions have only Germany to thank for their cultural development.
All diesen östlichen Gebieten tiefste Barbarei herrschen. Wenn Polen versuchen sollte, auf dem Weg zollpolitischer Maßnahmen Danzig wirtschaftlich zu vernichten, dass dann Deutschland nicht mehr länger untätig zusehen könnte.
I told the Polish ambassador 3 weeks ago that if situation continued as it was, if Danzig were persecuted and it were attempted by Poland to ruin Danzig economically, the situation could not be tolerated.
We interrupt this broadcast of Adolf Hitler's speech just momentarily to report a dispatch from Paris which says that Premier Daladier of France has now called the French Council of Ministers for an emergency meeting which is to take place just 10 minutes from now at 5:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Provokationen begangen. Meine Friedensliebe und meine endlose Langmut soll man nicht mit Schwäche oder gar mit Feigheit verwechseln.
No one should confuse my patience with cowardice. The first answer to the proposals which I made to Poland was Polish general mobilization, and the second was further terrible atrocities committed by the Poles on Germans.
Mit Polen in der gleichen Sprache zu reden, mit der Polen und seit Polen.
I therefore resolved to speak to Poland in the same language in which Poland has addressed us for such a long time.
Es war nur eine Frage.
Once again, we interrupt very briefly this talk by Chancellor Hitler to announce that in London, Parliament has been summoned to meet at 6 p.m. in London, which is 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time today.
In dem uns von Polen aufgezwungenem Kampfe zur Abwehr unerträglicher Übergriffe und zur Wiedergutmachung des uns zugefügten...
We shall fight to the bitter end against the Poles.
Der Reichstag verspricht in seiner eigenen Geschlossenheit jederzeit das Vorbild der Nation zu sein.
The Reichstag promises to be the example of the nation. Sieg Heil to the Führer. The Reichstag is present singing the German national anthem.
Finally, several broadcasts from the 3rd of September, 1939.
The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing Street. On September the 1st, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin was instructed to inform the German government that unless they were prepared to give His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom satisfactory assurances that the German government had suspended all aggressive action against Poland and were prepared promptly to withdraw their forces from Polish territory, His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom would, without hesitation, fulfill their obligations to Poland. At 9 a.m. this morning, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin informed the German government that unless not later than 11 a.m. British summer time, today, September the 3rd, satisfactory assurances to the above effect had been given by the German government and had reached His Majesty's government in London, a state of war would exist between the two countries as from that hour. His Majesty's government are now awaiting the receipt of any reply that may be made by the German government. The Prime Minister will broadcast to the nation at 11:15. That is the end of the announcement.
By the Prime Minister. I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland, whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning. His action shows convincingly that there is no chance of expecting that this man will ever give up his practice of using force to gain his will. He can only be stopped by force. And we in France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack upon her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage. At such a moment as this, the assurances of support which we have received from the Empire are a source of profound encouragement to us. When I finish speaking, certain detailed announcements will be made on behalf of the government. Give these your close attention. The government have made plans under which it will be possible to carry on the work of the nation in the days of stress and strain that may be ahead. But these plans need your help. You may be taking your part in the fighting services or as a volunteer in one of the branches of civil defense. If so, you will report for duty in accordance with the instructions you receive. You may be engaged in work essential to the prosecution of war or the maintenance of the life of the people, in factories, in transport, in public utility concerns, or in the supply of other necessaries of life. If so, it is of vital importance that you should carry on with your jobs. Now, may God bless you all, and may He defend the right. For it is evil things that we shall be fighting against. Brute force, bad faith, injustice, oppression, and persecution. And against them, I am certain that the right will prevail.
That is the end of the Prime Minister's statement. This is London calling in the overseas service of the BBC. In this emergency, we wish to keep you as closely as possible in touch with developments at home. So now, for a short period, you will be hearing a series of announcements to listeners in Great Britain on matters of urgent importance to them. After that, we shall give you news and announcements whenever we can.
It seems to me that there is hardly any place for comment on or interpretation of the news this morning. From hour to hour, during these days of tension and of strain, we, the people of the United States, have followed the events toward the climax this morning, which since Friday, when the German army attacked Poland by land and by air, has seemed to be inevitable. We, like all the other people in the world, regardless of government, have hoped and prayed that another way out might be found for the tragic dilemma of Europe. This morning we heard a voice, not a young voice, an old voice, a tired voice, and a sad voice, declare that he had done what he could to keep the peace, that he thought he had done everything possible. He had asked the German government to withdraw its troops and open negotiations, but his two notes, the last with a time limit, had brought no answer. So Europe is at war. All attempts at this moment to discuss the principles, the elements, and changes of front in this conflict seem out of place. But they will be discussed in the course of time, for facts are always related to principles and have little reality except in relation to them. This much is certain. A new page starts today in the history of the world. And a new page starts also in the history of our own country. We await tonight the President's message on our position as a neutral nation in this conflict. But over and above and more important, I think, than any position toward Europe which we may take today is the attitude that we take toward ourselves. Developments are sure to be rapid. They will move with lightning swiftness. No human mind can foresee the course of the next weeks and months. Forces have started that will take on a life of their own and assume unpredictable shape. Yet we may have much to do with molding the shape of things to come. Just now it seems to me our native love of peace should concentrate upon avoiding division and of achieving here, in this country, the maximum of unity and of goodwill, each to the other. In this country, a great continent lying between two oceans, live men and women who are the offspring of all the warring nations of Europe. And we have lived together in amity for 150 years, broken only by our most tragic era, the era that cut that age in two, our Civil War. Twice in our history, in 1812 and in 1917, we too cut that age in two, our Civil War. Twice in our history, in 1812 and in 1917, we too have been participants in a world war. But neither of those unhappy times could compare in horror to the 4 years in which we ourselves were divided and Americans fought Americans on American soil. Whatever this war may turn out to be, it did not come about because people did not have enough to eat. We seek for a guiding principle through the times to come. We can surely ask of every policy and of every idea, does it help forward a more perfect union? Does it aid justice? Does it help ensure domestic tranquility? Does it contribute to the common defense? Does it promote the general welfare? And will it defend and secure to ourselves and to our children the blessings of liberty?
You have been listening to Dorothy Thompson, outstanding woman commentator on world affairs. Miss Thompson will be heard again tomorrow night over most of these stations at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time.
5:30 Memphis time.
National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.
Just to bring you up to date on the news of Europe, if you are just turning on your radios, Great Britain is now at war with Germany. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced this fact in a broadcast at 6:15 New York time, 6:15 Eastern Daylight Time. A brief broadcast of about 5 minutes duration, which was carried over the CBS network. And the Prime Minister said that I have to tell you that we are now at war with Germany. We shall bring you further news as quickly as we have it, and we suggest that you keep tuned to your Columbia station.
London. This is London calling Columbia, New York. Now, first, let's get in proper order the chronological developments of the day. At 9 o'clock this morning, London time, it was announced that a two-hour ultimatum had been delivered to Germany, that at the end of that time, hostilities must cease, or Germany and Britain would be at war. At 11:15, the Prime Minister spoke to the nation. He stated that no reply had been received to the ultimatum, and that Britain and Germany were at war. Shortly after the Prime Minister's speech, the air raid sirens went off, and it wasn't a pleasant sound. We moved quietly and in orderly fashion down underground. The all clear came in just a little while. It seems that an unidentified plane had been seen approaching the coast. It was later found to be a friendly ship. Now, for the last few hours, I haven't had an opportunity to be up on the streets of London to see what is happening. I know that the House of Parliament is still in session. But I have heard one story concerning that air raid siren, and I think that story might interest you. It's told me by a friend of mine who was in Bond Street, and he said when the air raid siren went off, one man began to run. He ran for about half a block. He looked around, saw that no one else was running, and stopped, with perhaps the typical English desire not to be conspicuous. Now, while I've been underground, Mr. Bill Henry, of the editorial staff of the Los Angeles Times, has been up looking at the streets and the people of London. And here is his report. London is at war, and London has had its first air raid signal. But it has been the news that has been thrilling rather than the actual happenings in the city. London seems to take this war in stride. After all, you know, this is the weekend. And in Britain, the weekend is taken very seriously, so that the city is quite depopulated. A small group gathered before Buckingham Palace shortly before 11 o'clock, but there were a few more before the Waterloo Barracks, where troops were drawn up in the yard. Little knots of people stood around radios on corners, listening to the fateful words from Mr. Chamberlain as he spoke a few moments later. The first big thrill came a few minutes later when the intermittent blasts from whistles announced the first air raid signal. Groups on the street looked unbelievingly at one another. And then, as policemen and air raid wardens sounded the alarm, started for the nearest shelter. There was no panic. There was no undue haste. In fact, I should say that there was distinct reluctance to leave the streets. Most of the Londoners were anxious to have a look at the show, if indeed the raiders were coming over, as it developed later that they were not. Those who had good warning of the possibilities fished around in their little boxes for their gas masks, but they were in no hurry to put them on. I was in the Associated Press office when the signal came, and the newspaper men and operators, right up to their ears in the business of sending Mr. Chamberlain's speech to American newspapers, were in no mood to drop their work and go to the sandbagged shelter in the basement. The power in their sending machines, however, was immediately cut off, so they walked downstairs with a lot of kidding and with anything but panic or fear in the atmosphere. Most of them, indeed, were wishing that they might have photographs taken of themselves in their gas masks. My taxi driver, who drove me to the studio after the all-clear signal had been sounded, told me what happened to him when the air raid signal came. "Well," he said, "I was in the cab driving down the street when I heard the whistles, so I pulled up right off. You know, driving around the streets, I've had a fine chance to see where the air raid shelters are located, and there's certainly enough of them. So I hopped out of my car, and where do you think I was? At the Waldorf. And I've never been inside the place. A chap at the door was just closing it, and he says, 'Come on, me lad, up quickly.' So I went in. My word, I've never been in a place before, and there I sat in a ballroom just like a blooming millionaire while the sirens were sounding. I'd say that that was just a fair sample of the way that London took the first day of war."
That was Bill Henry's report of the streets and people of London. Now, as I told you a moment ago, the House of Commons is still in session. Sir Archibald Sinclair, leader of the Liberal opposition, has said, "I feel sure that at this grave moment, when we have listened to the moving speech of the Prime Minister, we should all wish to pay him a tribute of sympathy. But we are also in a mood of determination and resolution." The deputy leader of the opposition referred to the atmosphere of anger and apprehension which reigned in the House yesterday. "Today," he said, "the atmosphere is so happily changed. Yet, underneath those two phases, the mood is the reality of our determination to see this thing through. Let me associate myself in full," he said, "with the eloquent tribute on behalf of my friends and myself which the deputy leader of the opposition paid to the Polish people and to the Polish Parliament. Let me pay my tribute to the people of France, who have for so long been making such great preparations for the struggle with which we are now faced." The atmosphere of this House, according to the evidence of the opposition leaders, has changed overnight. Mr. Greenwood said, "Resentment, apprehension, and anger reigned over our proceedings last night, aroused by the fear that delays might end in national dishonor and sacrifice of the Polish people to German tyranny. Those feelings, I have reason to believe, were shared by large numbers of people outside, and from messages which have come to me this morning, what I said last night met with the approval of our people. This morning, we meet in an entirely different atmosphere, one of relief, one of composure, and one of resolution. The intolerable agony and suspense from which all of us have suffered is over. We now know the worst. The hated word war has been spoken by Britain in fulfillment of her pledged word. and unbreakable intention to defend the liberties of Europe. And now, let us bring you the latest news from Paris. This is London calling Paris. Go ahead, Paris. This is Morrow in London calling Paris. Go ahead, please, Paris. Hello, Paris. This is London calling Paris. Go ahead, please. While we're waiting for Paris, for just another few minutes, I'd like to tell you what Mr. Winston Churchill has just said in the House of Commons. He was received with general cheers, and he said, "In this solemn hour, it is a consolation to recall and to dwell upon our repeated efforts for peace. All have been ill-starred, but all have been faithful and sincere, and this is of the highest moral value. And not only moral value, but practical value at the present time, because of the wholehearted concurrence of scores of millions of men and women whose cooperation is indispensable and whose comradeship and brotherhood is indispensable. That is the only foundation on which the trials and tribulations of modern war can be encouraged and surmounted. This moral conviction alone affords that ever fresh resilience, that ever fresh resilience, which renews the strength and energies of peoples in long, doubtful, and dark days. Outside, the storms of war may blow, and the land may be lashed with the fury of its gales. But in our own hearts, this Sunday morning, there is peace. Our hands may be active, but our consciences are at rest. We must not underrate the gravity of the task which lies before us." Mr. Churchill said, "This is no war of domination or imperialism or to shut any country out of the sunlight and the means of progress. It is a war fought in its inherent quality to establish upon immovable rocks the rights of the individual. And it is a war to establish and revive the stature of man. It may seem a paradox that a war undertaken in the name of liberty and right should require as the necessary part of its progress the surrender for the time being of so many of our truly valued liberties and rights. In the last few days, the House of Commons has voted dozens of bills to confer on the executive the control of our traditional liberties. Those powers are not placed in hands which will abuse them or use them for party interests, but they will cherish and guard them. We must look forward to the day when those rights and liberties will be restored to us, and we shall be able to share them with peoples to whom such blessings are unknown." And there spoke Winston Churchill, the man who has sat through so many fateful meetings of Parliament in that corner seat beside the gangway. Now, for a moment, let us see again if we can contact Paris. This is London calling Paris. Go ahead, Paris. This is London calling Paris. Go ahead, Paris. It seems that for the moment, it has become impossible to reach Paris due to technical reasons. We shall hope to bring you at a later time today's news from Paris. And now I just have time to give you a bit of what Mr. Lloyd George, that white-haired Welshman and statesman of Britain, has said. He said that he was one of those who had from time to time challenged the government's handling of foreign affairs. But this was a different matter. The government were now confronted with the latest, and not the least, of a series of acts of brigandage by a very formidable military power, which, if they were left unchallenged, would undermine the whole foundations of civilization. He was only one out of millions of people in this country who would back any government that was in power in seeing this struggle through. He had been through this sort of thing before, and there was only one word he wanted to say about that. They had then very bad moments, moments when brave men were rather nervous and doubtful. But the nation was firm right through from beginning to end. By that,
means we went right through to the end after 4.5 terrible years. But we won a victory for right. And in the end, we will do it again. And those were the comments of Mr. Lloyd George. We shall hope to bring you later news from London today. We return you now to America.
This is New York, an Associated Press bulletin, London. King George VI held a meeting of his Privy Council at 11:15 a.m., which is 6:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 7:45 daylight time today. An Associated Press bulletin, Copenhagen. The Norwegian Admiralty today radioed all Norwegian ships at present en route to Europe's warring countries to proceed to the nearest Norwegian or neutral port. Associated Press bulletin, Montreal. The Canadian press announced that sensors were placed today in all cable offices in Montreal soon after British Prime Minister Chamberlain proclaimed Great Britain at war with Germany. And a bulletin, Berlin. With a declaration of war by France against Germany seeming inevitable at 5 p.m. Paris time, noon Eastern Daylight Time, the French embassy staff in Berlin today was prepared to leave the city at a moment's notice. It's understood that Sweden will take over French interests in Germany. Now, an hour and a half after the British Prime Minister announced that Great Britain was at war with Germany, there was an announcement over the German radio station, the reading of a memorandum of the German government which was handed to the British ambassador saying, in the last part, that the German government has to reject the British and French ultimatums, making the British government responsible for the encirclement policy and for not exercising a moderating influence on the Poles. This, of course, is what the German radio station said. After this, the appeal of German Chancellor Adolf Hitler to the German army to do their duty was read with the assurance that also the West Wall will protect Germany from attacks by France and England. The Polish radio station in Paris at 1 p.m., which was 8 in the morning Eastern Daylight Time, broadcast this to Germany. Hello, Germany. Hello, Germany. England has declared war on you. Then the radio spokesman added, there is only one thing left for me, and that is that I hope with what strength and power I have to forward the cause for which we sacrificed so much.
That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.